The commitment to realism concerns the question of metaphysics. The status and value of metaphysics has been controverted and disputed for much of the last 500 years. From the advent of Cartesian skepticism to its logical continuation in conscience objectivism, from Heidegger's radical critique of ontotheology to pragmatic and continental projects of anti-realism, what was once considered first philosophy has become arguably the most maligned discipline in contemporary philosophical thought. It is commonplace to view metaphysics with suspicion and contempt today. Why? Why has modernity cast metaphysics as a shackle on human reason? Why has postmodernity cast metaphysics as a kind of bondage and violence? And are any of these assessments warranted? In today's paper, I will first consider this critique of Western metaphysics. I will proceed to a discussion of Thomistic realist metaphysics in light of this critique. And I will then close with a reflection on Thomistic disputatio and how it relates to the question here at issue. Recently, the criticism of metaphysics has been taken up anew by the nihilist philosopher Johnny Vadimo. I would contend that Vadimo's work summarizes the principal contours of this debate. Vadimo advocates a flight from the so-called violence of any metaphysics of objectivity to the freedom of a supposed Augustinian love under the aegis of the ama et fac quod vis, love and do what you will. He argues that the discipline of metaphysics is an inherently violent undertaking, stemming from two sources: its classically conceived telos, which consists in the perfect identity of the end supremum, and its presupposition of nature as factum. In Vadimo's view, the latter, the givenness of being, demonstrates the implicit violence of every finality, of every principle that would silence all questioning. But why does Vadimo identify finality and facticity with violence? Why does he maintain that all truth claims, grounded as they are in factical being, inherently lead to domination? Why does he go so far as to equate objectivism with a totalitarian society? Vadimo presupposes the non-foundationalist tradition extending from Nietzsche through Heidegger. Heidegger, who continued Nietzsche's critique of metaphysics, sought to reestablish a bit of the grandeur of classical ontology. Yet he did this by stripping ontology from its classical foundation. For Heidegger, as for Nietzsche, metaphysics was understood primarily as a tool of justification. It was, in Heidegger's estimation, hopelessly foundationalist, precisely because it delimited what could be known and how it could be known. Metaphysics grounds not only intelligibility, but also meaning and history. In a very real sense, it tells us who we are. Because metaphysics ontically grounds and theologically legitimates our current understanding of being, Heidegger deemed all of metaphysics to be ontotheology. In Vadimo's view, Western metaphysics threatens current pluralistic society, precisely because it is predicated on the unity of truth, as much that we've heard about today. Since Vadimo equates unity and truth with ideology, he opposes on principle any classical metaphysical claims. In fact, Vadimo characterizes Christian metaphysics and belief as a fundamentalism that excludes authentic pluralism. The Church's supposed fundamentalism not only grounds her alleged repressive sexual ethic, but also her intolerance of other religions, and it justifies her violent evangelistic efforts. Now, it's clear that Vadimo is not underscoring chiefly physical violence. Rather, in his view, any metaphysical act is always an inherently violent act. Our task now is to examine the legitimacy of Vadimo's critique. Several questions present themselves upon consideration of his comments. The first question this critique gives rise to is, whose metaphysics is being critiqued? Clearly, there are different conceptions of metaphysics, both East and West. Even within the context of Western thought, metaphysics is not a monolithic thing, as the most cursory consideration of the Greeks or the medievals would demonstrate. The history of metaphysics is both broad and deep. Since the Western critique of metaphysics is, at its foundation, a departure from realism, it would seem that a distinctly realist metaphysics ought to be engaged, and here we are led to Aristotle and Aquinas as prime examples. Again, since the postmodern critique of realist metaphysics has also taken the form of a critique of so-called ontotheology, it would seem that Thomist metaphysics is a better case study than Aristotle. But more than that, just as Vadimo, in my estimation, is a sort of compendium of the Western anti-metaphysical stance, so too is Aquinas the paradigmatic Western metaphysician. We will begin here. An assessment of the whole of Thomistic metaphysics is beyond the scope of this paper, obviously. But I would like to investigate three elements of Thomistic thought, which are particularly germane to the Western critique of metaphysics. First, I will look at Aquinas' understanding of love as a habit. I contend that with this as a foundation, we might consider metaphysics to be ultimately the love of being. Second, I will examine the Thomistic ordering of the sciences and demonstrate its relation to Aquinas' realism. Third, I will conclude this section with a consideration of the Thomistic conception of truth as an adequation between mind and thing. First, metaphysics as the habit of loving being. Thomas notes that the word habitus is derived from habere, to have. This having can be either predicamental or relational. Relational having is a disposition, either positive or negative, towards that to which one is related. Habit, Thomas tells us, is a disposition in relation to a thing's nature and to its operation or end, by reason of which disposition a thing is well or ill-disposed. Excuse me. In other words, the end determines the goodness of the disposition. Within the context of habit, love is a special case, for it is both a virtue, and therefore a stable disposition, and a passion, and therefore prone to movement. As a habit, love is a disposition towards the other, a having of the other, a possession. It is grounded in an affinity for the one towards the other. Hence, love, Thomas writes, implies a certain connaturality of the lover for the thing beloved. And yet, Thomas also admits that love is a passion. Since a passion is the effect of the agent on the patient, then love also implies movement in the natural sense, and not simply stability or final possession. Love, under the aspect of an effect on an agent, points to the inherent passivity, or better, receptivity of the patient. Love is received by the patient. It is, as it were, the reception of the agent itself. There is a distinction between higher and lower forms of love, which Aquinas distinguishes under the aspect of the love of concupiscence and the love of friendship. Thus, Aquinas writes, quoting Aristotle, that to love is to wish good to someone. The person to whom one wishes good constitutes the object of the love of friendship, as opposed to the goods, plural, that one wishes to one's friend, which constitutes the object of concupiscence. This is because we love a friend for him or herself alone, but we love goods for what they can do for us. True friendship is not grounded in the dissipation of concupiscence, but in the simplicity of love. While it might seem contradictory to consider love as both a habit and a passion, they are conciliated thus. Love incites desire, and when what is desired is obtained, love incites joy. Desire denotes movement towards the object of love, thus it is a passion. Joy denotes the final rest of possession of that which is loved, thus it is a stable disposition or a habit. One could argue that metaphysics can be understood as the disposition of loving being. Under the aspect of a passion, metaphysics enshrines our desire for being. We desire being, and as knowers, we are receptive to being, which acts upon our knowing, even as an agent acts on a patient. Under the aspect of a habit, we have being. We are always already in possession of being, and ultimately we are the friends of being. Taken together, one might say that metaphysics is a disposition of desiring and loving being, that being which presents itself to us in truth, according to the convertibility of the transcendentals. Metaphysics, therefore, is a disposition of being towards being, of an openness to being or receptivity. But receptivity refuses to dominate what is received. More precisely, it refuses to construct being. It refuses to impose one's will on being. Instead, it is content to receive being, and this in proper relation. In this sense, objectivity is nothing other than the freedom of being to present itself to us as it is, rather than the imposition of one's own thought or will upon it. Such an imposition, I would argue, is more common to projects of both subjectivism and constructivism. Objectivity, therefore, is contrary to its critics, the very opposite of violence. It is relationship, humility, non-dominance. It is love. Metaphysics is to be understood as the disposition of being towards being in love. It is a charitable comportment, not a violent one. This is evident in multiple places in Thomas's thought. In Thomas's ordering of the sciences and the Thomistic understanding of truth as adequatio, we see two concrete examples of metaphysics as charitable comportment towards being. First, the ordering of the sciences, which was covered quite well, obviously, by Father White. Okay, it is important to emphasize that Thomistic metaphysics is not primarily concerned with either the subject or the object, as would be construed by modern and postmodern thinkers. Rather, metaphysics first and foremost concerns being. The consideration of being surmounts the subject-object dichotomy because both subject and object are beings. The history of interpretation of Aristotle's Metaphysics Book 6 has resulted in two chief conceptions of the subject of metaphysics. Some have held that the subject of metaphysics is being qua being. This interpretation was carried forth by Alexander of Aphrodisias and Avicenna. Others held that the true subject of metaphysics is a material being. This was the position advocated by the vast majority of commentators, from Asclepius and Simplicius to Averroes. Aquinas, for his part, follows the first interpretation of Aristotle. The subject of metaphysics is being qua being. Therefore, metaphysics concerns both material and immaterial being because it takes up being as ens commune. In short, for Thomas, metaphysics concerns simply what is real. As many Thomistic commentators of the last century and a half have noted, Thomas's innovation and contribution to metaphysics includes the positing of a real distinction between existence and essence and created being. This distinction grounds his metaphysics over and against Plato and Aristotle. This distinction does not, however, imply that for Thomas, metaphysics only takes up esse as the act of being. For Thomas, the subject of metaphysics is ens commune, and as one commentator writes, quote, metaphysics considers reality and the being of things, but in a universal way and without excluding the essence, end quote. Here we see the significance of the well-traversed debate concerning the point of departure of Thomistic metaphysics. Does the point of departure of metaphysics lie in the separatio or in the abstractio? The question concerns whether the speculative sciences proceed by way of abstraction from materiality, with metaphysics representing the most complete abstraction, or whether metaphysics presupposes the demonstration of a material being in natural philosophy and is therefore grounded in this judgment of separation. Following St. Thomas's exposition of the matter in the commentary on Boethius's De Trinitate, which Father White has already stressed the importance of, it seems that Aquinas takes the judgment of separation to be the point of departure of metaphysics. This is, of course, the foundational premise of the River Forest School. The separation concerns the difference that obtains between immaterial being, so the unmoved mover proven in physics and the immortal soul proven in faculty psychology, and other beings. It is a judgment of difference that not all being is of this kind, that there is material and immaterial being from which follows the concept of being as such, ens commune, encompassing them both. Fundamentally, the choice of the separatio as the point of departure of metaphysics means that despite the fundamental emphasis that Aquinas places upon being as esse in his metaphysics, ens mobile is the being that we know best and through which we human beings come to know any other kind of being. If the point of departure of metaphysics is in the judgment or separatio, if, therefore, metaphysics is grounded in natural philosophy, ought not natural philosophy be considered first philosophy? It is clear that for Thomas, though metaphysics is first philosophy in the sense of the nobility of its object, being qua being, natural philosophy is first in the order of investigation or generation. Central to Thomas's ordering of the sciences is the position that the existence of immaterial being must be demonstrated prior to the investigation of metaphysics as noted above, and this to ensure the realist objective stance. Thus, Thomas writes, quote, the philosophy of nature would be first philosophy if there were no other substances prior to mobile corporeal substances, end quote. And this is also repeated elsewhere in the commentary on the metaphysics. By this he means that only after we prove the existence of immaterial being in natural philosophy do we find ourselves capable of undertaking metaphysics. Okay, what is the significance of this ordering of the sciences for our contemporary critique of metaphysics? I would argue that the order of the sciences is grounded in Thomas's metaphysics of knowledge and is analogical to it, though this comparison should not be overdrawn. One need not submit to a conceptualist analysis in order to ascertain that the turn to ens mobile, which precedes the turn to immaterial being, mirrors the movement to convert into the phantasm and abstraction in Thomas's metaphysics of knowledge. Just as knowledge begins with sense perception, the conversio ad phantasmata, and proceeds to the concept via abstraction, so too do the disciplines according to the order of generation begin with natural philosophy, grounded in the experience of individual concrete objects before proceeding to the study of being and metaphysics. And yet, despite this ordering, metaphysics is first in the order of perfection, according to Thomas. Just as perception is ordered towards knowing and cannot be at rest until it knows the object, so too is natural philosophy ordered towards metaphysics and finds its fulfillment there. Taken together, Thomas's ordering of the sciences and his overall metaphysics of knowledge are grounded in a comportment of humility before being that allows being to present itself to us. contrast Thomas's metaphysics with Vadimo's assertion that, quote, metaphysics' need to grasp the origin or arche is deeply linked to hubris, end quote, because it is an expression of the desire to know rather than the desire to love. Since for Thomas, metaphysics ultimately ends in and is therefore oriented towards knowledge of God, a God to whom the human person can only be united in love, that is, for whom love and not knowledge is the criterion of union, there is no conflict between the aims of knowledge and the aims of love. Nowhere is this humility more evident than in the Thomistic conception of truth as adequatio. Truth, Aquinas tells us, is the adequation between mind, ratio, and thing, res, the classical assertion of which we find in the first question of the De Veritate. What is important about Aquinas' definition is the line that he draws between the truth of being, that is, how it presents itself to us objectively, and our subjective appropriation of that truth by the mind and judgment. Again, one can see in Aquinas' understanding of truth just how he avoids the pitfalls of a simplistic objectivism or any subjectivism. Truth is always ordered towards the intellect. It is simply to be known as real. Without an apprehending and judging intellect, there is no truth. Does this mean that Aquinas really is a subjectivist after all, since he says that truth in its fullest and most perfect sense is the truth of the intellect? No. Because he at the same time holds in view the essential intelligibility of being, which is precisely its power lent to the intellect to conform itself to it. In other words, the truth is first and foremost the truth of the intellect. The power of adequation rests in real being. Truth is therefore both in the intellect and the thing. Being makes the mind conform to it through its intelligibility. Judgment determines the truth of being. Here we see the beautiful interplay of the Thomistic system. We are not, as intelligent persons, simply automatons, encountering an environment or field of being upon which we have no role to play, casual observers of being. But neither are we the measure of being. Rather, we are receptive to being as it presents itself to us, and we confirm the truth of being in our judgment. There is, for Aquinas, no dominance over being. The dominance over being would better characterize, as I said before, a contemporary discourse. There is instead right relationship. Vadimo raises the question whether the entire tradition of metaphysical inquiry is inherently violent and domineering. But given our considerations, perhaps a better question is modern subjectivism or postmodern constructivism inherently violent? Vadimo presupposes that any effort to attain objective metaphysical knowledge is inherently flawed. Yet does it not do violence to impose ourselves upon the objects of our world in which being presents itself to us? Does it not do violence to reshape the other in my own image? Does it not do violence to inform being rather than to receive being? And is it true charity to prohibit the object from making itself known as independent of my own volition or rationality? Ultimately, it would seem that the habitus of metaphysics better expresses the rightly ordered relationship between person and world than does the sort of subjectivism and constructivism that Vadimo advocates. For to be metaphysical is simply to love being. Okay, our last section, Disputatio. The realism that forms the foundation of Thomistic thought pervades the whole of his project, its philosophy and its theology, its method and its form. For this reason, we might consider the Disputatio, the form in which the Summa, among other texts, is written, as the form of Thomistic realist metaphysics, and this we might find quite instructive. For just as metaphysics, as it has been defined in this paper, is the openness to being as such, to a sincere love of being as it presents itself to us, and not as a mere extension of myself as refracted through my own subjectivity, so too is the Disputatio the specific linguistic form of this openness to being, to the other as he or she presents themselves to us. And for this reason, I would argue that it is paradigmatic for academic discourse. No doubt, the form of the medieval Questionis Disputata precedes Aquinas, and yet it would be hard to argue that there is another who brought the form to such a level of perfection. By the time of Aquinas, at least two forms of Disputata reigned, the dialectic approach and that of the Questionis. Departing from Book 8 of Aristotle's Topics, the dialectical form was grounded in discourse as competition. The point was to best one's opponent. In the Questionis Disputata, on the other hand, the opponent was replaced with the interlocutor, alongside whom one is engaged in a sincere search for the truth. This form of Disputatio is grounded in dialogue rather than competition. The Questio itself, which preceded the Questionis Disputata, were grounded in close readings of foundational texts and the clarification of truths found there. This is extended in the Disputatio. What is of importance is that in Disputatio the truth is sought precisely by attending to the sincerest held and most convincing and cogent objections to one's own view. It is to the credit of Thomas and those who followed closely in his footsteps that strawman arguments were impermissible, as was ridicule or posturing. Joseph Pieper notes, in fact, that many times Aquinas presents the opposing view more convincingly than the interlocutor, so convincingly that Aquinas at times has been interpreted as advocating the opposing position. And this would be abundantly obvious if you ever tried to teach Aquinas to undergraduates, actually. The point was to discern the truth about a particular issue, to discern what conforms to reality, to the way things really are, to a reality that exceeds in its fullness my grasp or that of others to fully penetrate. If the disputatio employed by Thomas could be summarized in a word, it would simply be dialogue. In its 12th and 13th century form, the disputatio was constituted by first, the careful establishment of objections, and secondly, an appeal to tradition prior to the exposition of one's own view. In this, the disputer took on a twofold listening posture, listening both to the objector and to one's own tradition. The point was not to harmonize the two voices, a modern strategy, which again might lend itself to domination or hegemony. In a potentially unresolved disputation, one does not only listen to the other, but also if it is true dialogue, one must speak. This is a radical departure from more recent projects in academic dialogue. Nor is the point simply to listen with an understanding that the truth cannot be ascertained. Rather, the point is to listen, presupposing that one's interlocutor has a contribution to make towards understanding the truth. This contribution may take the form of a correction of one's own viewpoint or as a clarification of the truth gleaned from the error of the interlocutor. To again turn to Pieper, disputatio is directed fully at the interlocutor as a person, and it draws its vitality from respect for the other's dignity, and even from gratitude towards him. By the time of the 13th century, disputatio was a foundation of both teaching and research in the university. And in fact, Thomas considered the spirit of the disputatio equivalent to the spirit of the university itself, that latter being a quote from Pieper. Vadamo's characterization depicts traditional Western metaphysics as a violent imposition of my will on the other. But a sympathetic look at the nature of Thomistic disputatio reveals, quite to the contrary, a search for truth characterized by careful attention and sincere listening and receptivity. Thomas's ordering of the sciences and his understanding of truth as adequatio exhibit the humility that undergirds his whole metaphysics, a humility that is open to being as it presents itself to us. And Thomas's conception of love as a habit provides suitable language for understanding his own metaphysics as a project of love of being. Rather than a paradigmatic instance of hegemonic control over another, Thomistic metaphysics offers a clear lesson in humility and a sincere quest for truth. In our current age of echo chambers, fake news, and fractious academic discourse, Thomistic disputatio could actually teach us much about collaborative inquiry. If we dismiss it too easily and inaccurately as hegemonic will to power, we forfeit an example we so desperately need. The great Thomist, Father Reginald Garrigou-Lagrange, contended that the value of Thomism for our present age lies in the fact that it restores the love of truth for the sake of truth itself. And here we return to the theme inaugurated by Professor Cavadini. He argues further that this natural disposition of openness to truth, to being, is the natural foundation for the supernatural gift of divine charity. Here he summarizes, I think, what Thomistic realism can offer the modern academy. Thomistic metaphysics considers reality in light of its otherness, in light of its being, rather than strictly in relation to an individual's subjectivity or private or even social constructions. Being in the Thomistic system comes to meet us, and we are not free to determine how and in what form it will do so. In modernity, a basic choice had to be made, which is prior. Modernity chose knowledge over being, and so subordinated reality to the rational I. Postmodernity, too, had a choice to make between knowledge and personal freedom, and chose the seeming freedom of anti-realist constructivism. But appearances can be deceiving. The choice of knowledge reduced reality to the human mind alone, and the results of this in colonialism, environmental crisis, etc., have been punishing. The choice of constructivism has reduced reality to the infinitesimally narrow box of human-women will, and the results are no less severe. The remedy is a robust realism that allows the other as nature, as persons, or as being itself, to present itself to us as such and to be loved in its own autonomous value. Thank you.
So I would like to just thank Jessica Murdoch for this paper, which I, to the extent that it makes specific claims, am pretty much in complete agreement. So on those, I have very little, if anything, to say. For me, the question that arose in the course of reading the paper was rather in what ways the particular insights that it advances can be staged today, and in what ways perhaps the rupture that Vattimo certainly presupposes between a pre-modern and realist and a modern and emphatically anti-metaphysical framework, to what extent that rupture is as definitive and as sort of can be localized with the kind of specificity that Vattimo, for one, seems to believe. So let me take up a few, in the form of some questions then, points that have to do rather with the wider mission of the knowledge that Jessica Murdoch has just shared with us. Regarding her observation on metaphysical knowing as a form of love, quote, a disposition of being towards being and openness towards being, I have two questions. First, to what extent is this insight specifically Thomist? Some 600 years before, Maximus the Confessor remarks how, quote, rational creatures, qua created beings, are surely subject to motion, and when moved intellectively toward becoming a knowing intellect, such a creature surely loves that which it knows. So does a specifically Thomist account of metaphysics perhaps risk isolating itself, rather than seeing Aquinas in substantial continuity with patristic writing, and in this particular instance also echoing Platonic motifs? In the same vein, now projecting forward, I should like to raise the question about Murdoch's clear and persuasive exposition of Thomism's conception of truth as adequatio. As she puts it, Aquinas holds in view the essential, and here I quote, holds in view the essential intelligibility of being, which is precisely its power lent to the intellect to conform itself to it. Now, it turns out that rather similar accounts can be found in the work of Michael Polanyi, Edmund Husserl, John McDowell, to mention just a few. Husserl, for example, recognizes that if a thing's aspectual presentations, as they unfold in a cascade of sort of aspects over time, if they are to issue in a coherent perception at all, then, quote, the being must be governed by a certain teleology. Likewise, McDowell affirms a fundamental compatibility of mind and world such that, quote, the basic conceptual contents are already possessed by the impressions themselves, impingements by the world on our sensibility. So, leaving aside that the Gianni Vattimos of the world do not, at least not yet, hold a monopoly on conceptions of knowledge, surely a relief to us all, ought we not to put Aquinas in conversation with other thinkers, including those I just mentioned? I raise this question because I believe that there are disciplinary and institutional reasons for socializing Thomism more widely. Doing so involves not only praising Aquinas' use of disputatio but applying it. For example, by placing Thomism in a robust and open-ended dialogue with critical realism and phenomenology in particular. Such an approach ought to dispel a notion widely held by secular academics and not always contested with due vigor by contemporary Thomists, that the study of Aquinas is for the most part an inward-looking and overly specialized version of Catholic philosophical theology. Finally, and related to this suggestion, I wonder whether even to advance substantive intellectual arguments against Vatimo's sweeping indictment of metaphysics does not already give that philosopher too much credit. Might we not instead begin by pointing out that, in fact, modernity has never even come close to overcoming metaphysics and its putative violence, as Vatimo would have us believe? Now, most of those assembled here today, myself included, may well accept Murdoch's critique of Vatimo. Even so, to contest his indictment of metaphysical realism's supposedly violent character, and to do so from an exclusively Thomist position, actually carries the risk, however inadvertent, of reinforcing the underlying antinomy of a pre-modern and a modern. Instead, taking a cue from Alistair MacIntyre, I would urge that the first objective ought to be to show and demonstrate the incoherence of Vatimo's position and how it fails on its own terms. Doing so by recalling Aquinas' conception of truth, metaphysics, and the hierarchical order of the sciences is, of course, enormously helpful. And Jessica Murdoch's paper helps us understand and bear in mind these central points very well indeed. Yet Vatimo not only misconstrues Thomist metaphysics to the extent that he bothers to engage with it, but he also seems to be operating with a curiously simplistic notion of a post-metaphysical modernity supposedly at hand to supplant that framework. Now here, it bears pointing out that the major figures associated with an anti-metaphysical modernity, and I'm thinking here of Hobbes, Locke, Spinoza, Hume, Hegel, perhaps Hegel, Nietzsche, and Heidegger, that they were always being shadowed in their own time by counter-narratives of various kinds. Thus, among Hobbes' contemporaries and fiercest critics were the Cambridge Neoplatonists. And Locke's most famous student, the Earl of Shaftesbury, honored his teacher, as we all should, by subjecting his epistemology and agnosticism to a vigorous internal critique. Newman, Kierkegaard, Blondel, and the young Barth, their profound differences notwithstanding, subjected the anti-metaphysical axioms of 19th century bourgeois historicist and liberal Protestant theology to withering critiques. And Heidegger's domineering, quote, destruction of ontotheology was vigorously and, taking the long view, I think, effectively critiqued by Shavara, Edith Stein, and Hedwig Conrad Martius. In a way, then, the art of disputatio has never truly been lost. To be sure, as an organizing principle for philosophical and theological inquiry, seen within a single text, it had indeed long ago been supplanted by an anthropomorphic paradigm of systematic philosophy that declared itself not only capable of dispensing with transcendentals of any kind, but made that very step all but mandatory. As a result, disputatio has all but disappeared from theological and philosophical writing since the 17th century. And yet, all this time, it has remained alive and well in the agonistic struggle between an anti-metaphysical tradition that time and again has found itself checked by robust theist and realist forms of inquiry. It is in this prolonged dialectical tangle of philosophical and theological voices, rather than as a self-contained and mostly inward-looking enterprise, that Thomism promises to be an enduring and vital presence in the strangely inchoate intellectual landscape of our own times. Thank you.
Thank you. Professor Howell, those are wonderful comments. I would say first that what Maximus Husserl, the Cambridge Neoplatonist, Kierkegaard, Barth, Edith Stein, I may have missed some. What they all have in common is that they articulate some form of idealism. And that's precisely why I think Thomism is the most outward-looking, rather than inward-looking, of the sort of discussion partners to contemporary philosophy. So in a sense, I feel like your comments kind of proved my point.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good.
So, thank you. It does. So
I did it very slyly, though.
So to your first question, you asked, to what extent is this insight that metaphysics is the love of being, as it presents it to us, specifically Thomistic? Now, obviously, Thomas is indebted to his own predecessors, particularly Aristotle, and I would say Plato, most importantly, in terms of the participation theory.
Mm-hmm.
But inasmuch as we're talking about the theological turn and not a strictly philosophical one, Thomas is really the paradigmatic thinker. Everyone else tends to resolve themselves into a kind of idealism, which, again, can be seen as a way to internalize otherness, to eliminate alterity altogether because of its refraction through one's own inward subjectivity. That's the first point. Second, you said that truth is adequatio when I was speaking about the power being lent to the intellect from the thing. You said that in Husserl, you raised Polanyi and Husserl. If I could speak to Husserl again, to what extent is Husserl, even as a phenomenologist, really outward focused, considering that the foundation of his philosophical movement is the bracketing of the Lebensfeld? It seems that we still are cast upon a certain kind of subjectivism, even if in a sort of phenomenological form. And then lastly, maybe second to lastly, penultimately, you said, why Vadimo? Vadimo himself is not particularly important. He's a bit of a hack. But what Vadimo does do is he is a wonderful summary of the entire tradition. So rather than spend an hour, you know, going from Descartes through Derrida, Vadimo is just a useful compendium. So in that sense, he's a stand-in. Not a cheap stand-in. He makes some very, very important claims, I think. Particularly, I think, if we were sort of read him through the lens of Kristeva. But the point is that he's kind of a compendium of the entire anti-metaphysical trend. And then finally, lastly, why Thomism over all of the other schools that you recognized? Simply because I think they're not as persuasive. I don't think that the Cambridge Neoplatonists, I don't think that Kierkegaard, I don't think that Barthes, I don't think that Edith Stein are as persuasive because of their idealistic or phenomenological foundation. I really think that the moment calls for this robust realism that is a very easy dialogue partner for the natural sciences, but also a very good counter-narrative, to use your language, to our increasing anti-realism. Thanks.
Just a brief response here, and I think we are going to try and model a certain form of dialogue. The way that In your response here, the word idealism functions, I think, is one that I think would need to be scrutinized. You mentioned, interestingly enough, just in passing, that Plato's conception of participation is sort of an important feature.
For sure.
And I fully agree. Now, the concept of participation in Plato and Methexis is in some ways one that tends to be consistently overlooked by those who posit a kind of division or split between the ideal and the real and the material realm, this chorismos. Gadamer has wonderfully written about that in his wonderful book on the idea of the good in Plato and Aristotle. And I do think that the concept of participation is in fact one that both tempers, but also in a way presupposes an idealism. So that it strikes me as in no way to the discredit of writers who one might, in a colloquial sense, characterize as having idealist tendencies, provided, and this is a point on which I would certainly concur with Aquinas' sort of overall view, provided that there is that the temptation, which I think is always going to be there, will be firmly resisted, namely the temptation to think that these ideals are something of which we can take, in a sort of robust anthropomorphic or technocratic sense, possession.
Mm-hmm.
That as long as we understand that all forms of knowing, sort of in a pseudo-Dionysian sense, really are always already checked by the ultimate unknowability and by the merely analogical relationship that our names and our concepts have.
Analogical, but not merely.
Yeah. Right, indeed, yes. As long as we understand that, I think that there are that a robust conception of transcendence is certainly commensurable with some of the moves that you characterized as idealist. So idealism can, I think, sort of become, in the modern era, perhaps inevitably, will begin to be assimilated to sort of subjective flights of imagination, as though this was something for which the individual in the grip of such flights can take full credit.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to think of idealism rather as a form of responsiveness to the givenness of being. And so in that sense, I do not see it antithetical.
I think it depends on which idealist. I mean, I agree with you to an extent. If we're speaking strictly of Plato,
mm-hmm.
and perhaps of a few Platonizing Thomists, but that hardly seems to be the case, I think, of contemporary phenomenology, in my assessment.
Right. So on Husserl, I think I'll largely concede your point, although I would say that the very early Husserl hadn't quite jumped down the rabbit hole of idealism in the way that by 1913 he does. So
what
if
about
you look,
Kierkegaard and Barth? So for them,
right.
We're not looking at the phenomenology piece. We're looking at the lacto dialogia intus, which I think is crucial.
I agree. Yeah. No, on that point, I think we are finally in agreement. Yeah. Quite so.
So it comes down to the Cambridge Neo-Totemist.
Well,
we've narrowed it down.
No. I mean, I would say no. My point was that that one of those schools will, in every respect, sort of present as balanced, a capacious, and ultimately persuasive a vision as Aquinas. My point was rather that being where we are in the 21st century, I think it's very important to see how certain crucial motifs that are integrated into a beautiful systematic conception in Aquinas actually have had a long afterlife.
Sure.
And that we should, I think, be very responsive and in a way also take the sort of philological and hermeneutic trouble of teasing these reappearances out in more recent texts. Because otherwise what we allow is to take hold is this this kind of almost Gnostic conception of a modernity that is fervently, if not particularly intelligently, anti-metaphysical,
mm-hmm.
and a kind of lost era that we, in some sense, should be sort of reviving. I think the central claim that I sort of always see again in Aquinas is that, of course, the realism, the responsiveness to being, especially in the concept of the adequatio of mind and world, is actually a position that can only be obscured, but it cannot actually be positively given up on. Notwithstanding the shrill pronouncements of sort of, you know, constructivists running about, it's in that sense they haven't actually elaborated a coherent alternative, in part because many of them have not really engaged with Aquinas, but they sort of simply their narrative start, as you say at the beginning of your paper, you know, Vatimo for Vatimo, the world really comes alive with Nietzsche. Well, that's cutting out a whole lot. And my sense is that even in Nietzsche, that one would have to, I think, work very hard to make him mean only what Vatimo wants him to mean. So my sense is great texts will always exhibit a kind of internal division and conflict. They are not written because the writer, notwithstanding their rhetorical maneuvers, is absolutely certain of everything they know, but because they've actually struggled to get there. And in the struggle, we can pick up sort of seismic moments where, in fact, the core axioms of Thomism still shine through.
I love
and
that.
And that's my sort of...
I promise I'll let other people talk. But I love that. Perhaps. We won't go promises. I think I just want to add one more thing, is that I would never say that we need to revive a lost era. Because Thomism has never been lost.
That's my point.
That's my point. So there is no lost era. It's a 800-year continuous tradition that has constantly been expounded. So,
good.
The ever-present.
I'm sorry, I have noticed that there is a person who's a sort of nationally known expert on Aquinas' epistemology and knowledge of being in the room who has not said anything all day. I'm just wondering, Therese, Corey, do you want to weigh in? Did you write books about this subject? Now, do you want to say anything about Aquinas and knowledge of being, or am I putting you on the spot?
You are putting me on the spot, since you put me on the spot. So I actually wanted to maybe ask a little bit about what's being meant here by realism, or maybe think about what we mean by realism. And because it matters a great deal whether we think about realism in terms of a kind of maybe ability to reach out to the world or have the world sort of pressing on us and have a kind of direct contact with reality the way it is, or whether we think about realism in the manner of an adequatio. Mm-hmm. So it's possible for an adequatio to be a kind of conformity where the knower comes into a kind of assimilation with being without necessarily going all the way to say that we have access to things as they are in themselves. Mm. So there's a sort of question for me as to what kind of realism that we need to say that Aquinas defends. And I would very much advocate for the latter kind of realism as being sort of authentically what he had in mind. And so one of my worries here with the language of realism is that that this more robust kind of realism, where we really get at things as they are in themselves, that sort of is a kind of response that comes up after Kant, the sort of accommodation that neo-Thomism makes to the challenges posed by subjectivism. But it doesn't seem to me that this necessarily, within the framework that Aquinas offers us, that's the way he would think about it.
What are the advantages of his way of seeing it as you're articulating?
So if you think about the realism in terms of the conformity of the knower to being, then I think there's a lot more latitude for accounting for variations in our appropriation of, I won't say appropriation of being, but the way that different knowers can have, for instance, different perspectives on the same reality, where the perspectives are so different that we can hardly sometimes believe that they come from the same core sorts of experiences, but nonetheless are all getting at the same thing. And so I think for a notion of realism in terms of conformity to being, that allows us a lot more latitude to account for those differences, where I think it's much harder on these other more robust notions of realism to accommodate those very real divergences that are had between different knowers and the way that they experience reality.
Thank you. That's a wonderful comment. I think actually I would advocate the former, not the latter, in your country role, with this caveat that, I very much think that in Aquinas there is the very real possibility of grasping the Dingon Thich, but in himself, not as refracted through transcendental Thomism or any post-Kantian turn. Is this true for everyone and everything? Obviously not. I mean, obviously there's varying capacities of the actual concrete intellect that we're talking about. But I do think as a foundational point that possibility of really knowing the thing in itself is squarely in Thomas's conception of realism. This doesn't mean there's no conformity to the thing or that the thing itself doesn't sort of enter into the concept. I mean, certainly in sort of the first act of perception. You know, as you well know, Aquinas speaks beautifully about sort of going out to the thing and again, being conformed to it, and then receiving that sort of back into the intellect to form the concept, and then to make this the third act of judgment. But I think he does, in fact, hold for the possibility of getting at the truth of the thing that actually rises above the perspective, perspectives.
Yeah, so can I push? Just
feel free.
So I would want to distinguish between the claim that we can get at the truth of the thing arising above the perspectives, and the claim that the thing as it is in itself is sort of directly available.
No, I mean, this is not like a sort of naive realism in any way that I'm a proponent of, but I certainly don't think Thomas is a perspectivalist. Is that what I'm hearing?
No, but so I'm thinking of things like, so in the commentary on the Posterior in the Digs, where he says that we often don't know the nature of things at all, and so we substitute in for a definition of the nature of the thing. Very detailed description.
Yes.
And he says that's okay. This is, in fact...
Until it's later confirmed. Yes. But the still foundational point is that nature can be confirmed at a later date through further ratiocination. Not that it is beyond confirmation altogether.
Right.
I mean...
Just on this point, you said, of course, you're not a perspectivalist. Let me suggest, and this is here really sort of drawn just very briefly on the early Husserl, that for him, at least, and I think persuasively to me at least, a perspectival knowing is not incommensurable with realism. Husserl would essentially argue, and I mean, I think Robert Sokolowski's writings have made this very lucidly clear. His prose, I think, is arguably superior to Husserl's. It is, in a way, by definition, given to us as temporally, as time-bound beings, mm-hmm. that the way we get to know a thing is in time, sequentially, and at any given moment, only partially. However, it is also logically obvious that for me to even speak of a thing's aspects is to already posit that there are aspects of the same thing. Mm-hmm. So that my perspectival understanding does not negate the identity of a thing, but in fact understands and recognizes that I can only sequentially and partially and perhaps always inadequately come to know it. Now, I see this, I mean, it's so in that sense, perspectivalism, I think, got a very different kind of name as a result of Nietzsche. Because there the argument, of course, is that you have essentially different people and they see differently, which is presumably true, although it's also, in a way, an incontestable proposition. Mm-hmm. But I see it, I think, and in a way more interestingly, I see it in myself, and I know I see it in my students. Because they, one of the things that we see aspectually is when we do what I certainly have been doing for decades, which is read texts. And I read them in a certain sense, and then I come back to them later, and I read them again, and I see more, I see things differently, I weigh the semantic intensities of a given passage differently. And that, in a way, strikes me as both affirming the integrity and also, in a way, the wonder of the text, of the thing.
Mm-hmm.
It also reminds me that, in a way, I am not the owner, but I am the student, I'm the learner. And so, perspectivalism in that sense, if we are conscious and self-conscious about it, is also in a way a wonderful mechanism for inducing in us in a sense of humility vis-à-vis the object, which I think is very much in Aquinas' spirit. So that it is by no means a given, and in fact I think it's a bad misconstrue to think as so much postmodernism does, to think of perspectivalism essentially as a fast road to relativism. It's not that at all. For a thing to have perspectives only means something if, in fact, the integrity of the thing is posited. In that sense, Husserl, at least as late as 1907 in Ding und Raum, was very much a realist. And it's no accident that his most influential teacher was Franz Brentano, who was a great Aristotle scholar. So there is a clear precedent to that. So,
Teresa, is that what you mean?
I think my interpretation of why is to what was just said.
Because that makes a good deal of sense to me. I think I would just sort of linguistically make a distinction, perhaps too influenced by postmodernity. I would make a distinction between sort of just the fragmentary aspect of knowing versus what I would consider to be a perspectivalism. I mean, that fragmentary aspect I would never mm-hmm. deny. So that makes perfect sense to me, actually, if that's what you're getting at. Okay.
Yeah, and so one of the worries in the background here, right, is the whole debate about representationalism and realism in Aquinas that focuses on whether we, you know,
right.
whether the species sort of are in the way when we go.
Right.
Right. And then the worry is that whole framing puts us in a position where the only way to be a realist
right.
is to sort of go out there and grab all
yeah, no.
as it is in itself. And I think Aquinas just doesn't.
Right.
I mean, his realism is really the realism of confidence that when we use our reason properly, we can get somewhere, and we
okay.
can make progress in conforming ourselves to reality. But
in that sense, I think we are in agreement, and I think I misunderstood. Thank you.
Dr. Murdoch, thank you. Thank you, all three of you, for really enlightening and educatory precision. But I had a question on the way you presented Aquinas on metaphysics, because you started out talking about Heidegger's critique of ontotheology and
mm-hmm.
such, and the way you narrated it is metaphysics is a love of being and letting being present itself to the knower. I was wondering if you were trying to present it in a manner that would harmonize with, or at least parallel, the presentation that Heidegger gives in what is called thinking, where
yes.
it's unconcealment, you just sort of let, you know, let the world sort of reveal itself to
very
you.
Very intentionally so.
Thinking and thinking.
Yeah, no, I'm very intentionally drawing on the Heideggerian language to sort of recast and reinterpret that in terms of a Thomistic project. Yes, in fact, in other words, Heidegger fails. He fails miserably, but doesn't he have beautiful language? And let me tell you who can fill out that language would be Thomas. That's actually very intentional, yes. Thanks for asking. Particularly the friends of being, you know, and being out in the openness and, you know.
I have a brief comment. I was thinking that you were sort of defending yourself feistfully to Professor Powell, that, you know, there's this important work of Etienne Gilson in the middle of the century in 1948 called Being and Some Philosophers, where he argues that in everyone but Aquinas there's an essentialization of being or an idealistic reification, and only really Aquinas has grasped the sort of actus essendi, of the depths of esse, of the reality of existence and things. And Fabro pushed this kind of line of thinking as well in many ways. And they were pushing this way kind of against Heidegger, or in response to Heidegger, because of Heidegger's notion of the forgetfulness of being. And they were saying, listen, if you want to recall, there has been a forgetfulness of being. If you want to solve the problem, this is the way to go. And it was interesting how you sort of in relationship to Professor Fowle's pluralism, pushed back the idea that actually if you want to get alterity right, you Aquinas is like the answer to getting alterity right. You know, it was a sort of, because he's the one who teaches the love of being and its alterity and actually allows, I mean, that was very interesting how paradoxically you argued, Vada was saying metaphysics leads to the as it were, obscuring of the other, and you're saying, well, it's actually the opposite. It's particularly through the love of being and the radical capacity to grasp the actus essendi of the other that you make yourself docile to and adapt to the reality of being. It's very interesting. I was just a comment. Like, you sound to me like you're echoing Gilson. Does that ever occur to you?
Well, that's rare, I have to say. But yes, every now and again, I think there is some convergence there. I did not think of that until you just said it. I do tend to identify as Aristotelian Thomist. But yeah, I would agree with that. I think this might be the first time I've ever been in Favreau's camp, so this is very interesting to me. But yes.
Sir, you had something back there. Okay, yeah, so oftentimes one of the big problems for constructivist and anti-metaphysical philosophical views is this problem of self-contradiction. And, you know, the worry that, you know, if you say there are no truths, it's like, well, what about that? So, and in this context, was it Vadimo, was that the guy's name?
Yeah.
Right, this objection that metaphysics is sort of inherently violent, Well, who is he conceiving the sort of victim of this violence to be, or who is this, like, aggression directed against? Because if, as long as there is some victim, then presumably there's really some victim, right? So that already presupposes that there is something that objectively exists, right, in some way such that we can, you know, sort of, in a way that's contrary to its dignity, or...
I mean, I think, much like Heidegger and Nietzsche before him, he sees the victim as all of Western civilization that has suffered under this egregious Christian metaphysic. I mean, I think that's the main point. But to sort of narrow him down to his historical locus, he's Italian. And so I think that we're talking here about fascism. And he sees this as sort of the foundation of totalitarian thinking. So I think for him, that victim is all of us as the victims of a fascist or totalitarianism that sort of identified with the metaphysical project, at least as it's been understood in the Christian sense. The reason why I take Thomas again as paradigmatic is because he is filtered through Heidegger's critique of ontotheology. Otherwise, we really, in some sense, could stay with Aristotle. But I think... that's that point. The Christian realist metaphysics, in particular, he sees as the foundation for contemporary fascism.
Okay, yeah.
Which I think an awful lot of students today might say the same thing in less sophisticated language.
So is it just Christian realism, or is it any form of metaphysical realism?
That's a good question. He speaks about the church an awful lot, and I think in his sense we are talking about Christian and specifically Catholic metaphysics, actually.
I think that might help to avoid the self-contradiction problem, because then he could at least...
Right.
Yeah, but... I mean, I just, if the target is broad enough, then there really is a worry that he's just being inconsistent by suggesting that there are these people with rights, and we're kind of, you know, acting in a way that's contrary to these rights. But
well, I do think he does see that right as primarily constructivist. I have the right to construct myself as I see myself. I mean, he's sort of a, you know, like sort of the articulation of the 56, 44, 50, I don't know, genders. I mean, this is literally sort of like just that foundational thinking of my right, I mean, post-Sartrean, really, to construct myself as I see fit. And anything that does not respect that seeming right is a kind of dominance, is a kind of violence.
This in a way is an interesting question because... I had actually a little paragraph I struck because I wanted to keep my remarks short on exactly this question. Just, you know, I mean, on Mill's harm principle, you know, what just happened? Nobody got injured, you know. So what exactly is the, how does violence on this particular way in which it's used by or wielded by Vattimore, how does it phenomenalize itself? I have no idea. It is, I think, the arguments, and I think we are here in a rather apt place. You know? I mean, the modern university, which I think is sort of both an environment of hypersensitive, hyperdefensive, and often, I think, perilously self-enclosed beings. Is, I think, a great place in which to sort of raise that question. The idea of violence as a form, which I think would be the only default I can think of for Vattimore, would be one of sort of mental coercion. The question naturally then arises, well, wherein does that consist? If you and I, let's say we are, to the extent that we have been able to figure it out, vehemently at odds on any number of issues, we're now to really get into it and sort of examine each other's reasoning and say, well, you know, by, say, taking this position, you premise X, Y, and Z, are you sure you wish to hold those premises because they might actually not be even commensurable, et cetera. I could conceivably find that I've sort of shown your position to be internally incoherent, or conversely, you might have shown that about mine. In which case, I would consider that to be a great moment, because that's a moment where some form of knowing has genuinely transpired, and as a most welcome benefit, in a certain sense, also an authentic kind of community has momentarily been instantiated. If, however, we tend to think of knowledge as nearly convertible with personal opinion, something against which Plato wisely had warned long ago, then, and if we therefore sort of maintain a strictly proprietary view of what we know, which is in fact something we cherish because we've sort of grown comfortable with it, then naturally we might reject those kinds of critical queries as a form of mental coercion. But it does strike me in the larger scheme of things as utterly unfair to take that view, because that view would presuppose that for my views, I'm at no point other than of my own choosing ever accountable to anyone else.
And I'm
at. That view, in turn, would suggest that I somehow inhabit the world essentially in a kind of sort of in a high functioning sort of autistic way, as though I'm really not in any sense a part of a community simply in virtue of the fact that I'm here, but I am. So my being accountable for the views I hold should be a natural entailment of it. And you are challenging those views, if you find them to make no sense to you, would also make would be the right thing to do. So if anyone now comes about, up and declares that to be a form of intellectual violence, and I suspect that is sort of more or less what Vatimo is alleging, well, then I would say that is itself an argument that would have to be unmasked. And that's, I think, precisely what I meant when I said, you know, one needs to show that these kinds of arguments fail on their own terms. Before one, and of course, Thomism can be very valuable. For one thing, it is an immense mental discipline, and it will make us better at carving out sort of areas where something isn't right, where the edifice of someone else's thinking is clearly out of joint. But I do feel that the way that the term violence is used, especially in academia today, is I think in some ways parasitical on its similarly loose and irresponsible use in contemporary politics. Where, you know, everybody is sort of, you know, if the state doesn't like someone, well, they'll be, you know, deemed dangerous or terrorist or something. You know, they are a way of sort of painting people into a corner rather than engaging with them. And what I always admired and what I, in a way, found really on the rare occasion when I get to teach Aquinas to undergraduates, what I found wonderful is for them to see how impossible it is for them to locate in the text any kind of subjective and affective charge. It's just not there. And it actually causes them a good bit of disorientation, because that's usually how they are accustomed to pinning someone down. Not by what they, in an objective sense, hold, but by where their sort of affective center is. And it's good to deny them that, because then they have to look for something, they have to look for something else. So.
Oh, all right. So I wanted to ask, this might be a clarification, it might be a pushback, but you seemed at some point to sort of dismiss more competitive, agonistic, dialectic form in favor of disputatio. And sort of following up on the distinction I think might possibly be made between violence as the exertion of a force that might be in some ways beneficial, and if we let go of the sort of proprietary habitus of knowledge, then making ourselves open and available to the force of reality or to the force of being. It might not be a damaging force, but it might in many ways be a good one. And that versus harm. So would there be, on those terms, a sense in which a sort of competitive violence would not necessarily be detrimental or harmful?
Oh, I don't think so. I think it would be hurtful, personally, though I respect that viewpoint. I think this is a real advantage of 12th and 13th century disputata over, Aristotle's topics. The competitive nature, at least as I was articulating it, and as it was meant, and we see this really in the 10th and 11th century, It's all about showmanship. It's all about me besting my opponent. I would say that that seems to be what we have in the academy today. This is a funny, we're a little bit schizophrenic. On the one hand, I have the showmanship best my opponent side, and on the other hand, I'm like a fragile violet who can't stand anyone who disagrees with me. So those seem to be like sort of like the two extremes of the academy that are somehow held together, oftentimes in the same person. So I don't like that. So the thing about the competition is that it brings the focus back on, I guess, just the questioner, as opposed to the pursuit of truth. The idea of dialogue, and again, I want to be clear that by dialogue, I don't mean let's fall like a house of cards because someone disagreed with me, which again tends to be the academic understanding of dialogue. I simply accept what you said because, hey, you exist and you're a nice person, allegedly, because we're all nice people. No, but dialogue in the sense that there's a real pursuit of truth, and yes, I could be wrong, but on the other hand, I could be right and you could be wrong, but either way, the truth will be illuminated, either by your error or mine. Either by your truth or not your truth, like not in that Oprah way. I mean, like your assessment of the truth or mine. but so I don't like this idea of violence. You want to clarify that? You don't have to. I'm just, perhaps I didn't understand.
Maybe I'm missing the distinction that you're making in how you're defining dialectic. Is it by the form or is it by the intentionality of the participant? To win, to show off, to be the best.
Right now, intentionality, for sure.
Okay.
For sure.
Because I was hearing it more as being...
It's a sense of opposition.
Form is the problem, whereas the disputatio form that Thomas uses...
Let me say this. The form, as it's articulated in Topics 8, is precisely that we are in an adversarial relationship and only one of us can win. That is precisely what's in Topics 8. So the form itself has the intention of only one of us is winning.
I'm not as familiar with that. So when I hear dialectic, I'm thinking especially Platonic dialectic.
Right, so and that's a
and
wonderful
that's
thing.
A very
this is not that.
Sort of
right.
This is we're in a competition and one of us is going to win and one of us is going to die. That's sort of the point of the academic discourse. The innovation of the 12th and 13th century, and again, this precedes Aquinas, but I think he brings it to sort of perfection, is that it's no longer, you know, one of us has said to the lions. It's that there is a common pursuit of truth, and honestly, exactly as Professor Howe has just articulated that sort of very appropriate conversation of give and take, but also of claim and counterclaim is very much... at stake. But what I was going to say is, in response to this is that with someone like Vadimo, who again is our stand-in for, honestly, the majority of people in the academy today, is that there is no such thing as a knowledge claim at all. We aren't common knowers. We aren't knowers at all. There is no knowledge claim. So whether politically correctly or not, that idea of the high-functioning autistic image is actually, I think, quite good. I think that's really articulated quite well. But
I would perhaps add again or stress that in dialogue, more in the Platonic tradition, in a dialogue in which ultimately, even though at the local level of any given exchange, it needs to be very focused and also quite unsparing in its pursuit of the issue itself. But that when all is said and done, I think that it leaves both participants transformed, not just the one who may ostensibly come across as having had the lesser arguments that ultimately didn't prevail. Because it leaves them both transformed because they are now, in a certain sense, part of a community of exchange that didn't exist prior to submitting to the particular rigor of this form of speech. So that I think that that's another casualty of the purely adversarial model, is that we in a way don't understand that the very enactment of dialogic reasoning actually creates a higher order of good than the two discrete participants are each taken by him or herself. It creates a community. And I think it is especially vitally important, I think, in the contemporary university with its exceedingly specialized sort of pursuits, which I think puts us, for disciplinary and institutional reasons, more than ever at risk, and certainly more than in Plato's times, of simply sort of being the proverbial ships, no, sailing past one another in the night. And then I think it is in no accident that the kind of political strife and the sort of fundamental loss of clarity of vision when it comes to how do we actually engage with one another should be sort of should have descended on the university at this time, when specialization in a way has also rendered our idea of knowledge oddly muted and inexpressive. As knowledge is something you may publish, and if you can help it, you may occasionally have to talk to someone about it in the elevator. but it is no longer something that we understand very clearly as communally achieved. In some ways, I might actually suspect, and I don't have enough first-hand knowledge to be sure, in some ways, I think the idea of some biology lab is perhaps a more auspicious setting for it than sort of, you know, conferences or garden variety conferences among humanists. Because, for one thing, the task is very clearly defined in a lab. You're usually very clear about what it is that you're really trying to achieve, and I think it is usually recognized that you can only achieve it if everybody is in the know about the ultimate end of this particular project and in a way supports it and shares, for the sake of attaining that outcome, shares whatever information at any step along the way they have obtained. Whereas we, in a way, sort of have a way of receding into highly specialized and compartmentalized vocabularies. And I think that's become, to me, it's become incredibly apparent in the study of literature. The hyper-specialization has, I think, it's no accident that it has made it much harder for that discipline to maintain a coherent and effective account of its raison d'être within the academy.
I have to say, unfortunately, I think this is the same in the natural sciences as well. My background's in natural science, and I think that same competitive spirit is
see, and
prominent
for a
in
moment,
the labs.
For a moment, I thought it was better somewhere.
If you could help me thank Professor Smith.